Baby, oh, if you done the show, say you want to the carry go. I supposed to know, say you won't go solo on your own, all alone. I don't know. Oh, girl, you drive me crazy. Out of my mind, I cannot hide. I've been thinking about you lately. No matter how hard I try, I cannot fight. Sometimes I get so frustrated, and I'm losing my mind, bruising inside. I know I need you and I hate it. No matter how hard I try, I cannot fight. I still love you, I still love you, I still love you, babe. I still love you, babe. I still need you, I still need you, and I want you, I still want you, babe. I still want you. Oh girl, you done make me want to. Kololo, 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 my mate. Kololo, 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 yeah, bye. Kololo, 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 my mate. Kololo, 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 yeah. It's about the way you done make me lose my head. It's about the way I hate that I like that I like. Out of my mind, I cannot hide. I've been thinking about you lately. No matter how hard I try, I cannot fight. Sometimes I get so frustrated, and I'm losing my mind, bruising inside. I know I need you and I hate it. No matter how hard I try, I cannot fight. I still love you, I still love you, I still love you, babe. I still love you, babe. I still need you, I still need you, and I want you, I still want you, babe. I still want you. Oh girl, you make me want to. Kololo, 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 my mate. Kololo, 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 yeah. Kololo, 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 my mate. Kololo, 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 kololo. I just can't let you go. You know that I know, no, 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 no. I just can't let you go. Kololo, 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 my mate. Nobody like you. Kololo, 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 yeah, baby. Kololo, 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 my mate. Nobody like you. Kololo, 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 yeah, baby.
Listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. Yes, and good morning, dear listeners, specifically there with the sounds of Jamiroquai, that, and also before that, a little bit of Bangy W with the song, particularly Kololo. But, and obviously introducing this morning's segment of My Sunday Morning Take. Welcome, good morning, good morning, good morning, and obviously, it does seem there might be a little bit of a seasonal change in the air. Well, I cannot put, you know, sinus issues and random sneezing down to season in the air scenarios, but primarily because, you know, it does seem we are only now having an actual summer, the dry part of the summer. But this is a Sunday morning, primarily that also starts on a different note, and we have to see literally what the rest of the Sunday has in store for us in terms of climatic conditions and the likes. But separate from that, and separate obviously from what we always do here between 5 and 7 a.m. here on your number one talk radio station, welcoming you to My Sunday Morning Take. Now, we step into the realm, dear listeners, for this morning's session about regarding or about space exploration. I don't know where the extra letters keep popping up from specifically, you know, as I'm, you know, going through my train of thought. But we step into the morning, or into the realm specifically this morning, regarding space exploration and the developments that humankind obviously have made. But we are looking at the very first instances of space exploration, and primarily where this particular discussion comes from. Now, our discussion has us looking at the curiosity, obviously, that mankind has deployed in terms of understanding and, you know, for hundreds of years regarding what's going on outside of the world, the physical world as we know it, the world that is between the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere above us. And one of the most interesting things, obviously, has been in terms of a presentation that I watched, and it was these presentations that began just here after COVID, but it was one done by the physicist, Mr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He himself is a physicist, and he's a physicist that has, if I can call it podcasts, and you can find them all across the digital platforms, you know, out there. But the most interesting one that I obviously watched was on a video on Facebook, and he and this other actor, because I recognize the other guy as an actor, and it was an actor that obviously has had various particular roles. And then the actor would interview him about, you know, how we have to understand the physical world out there and currently what were the developments. Now, Tyson and the gentleman that's the actor, they obviously set this up because there was a lot of mis- and disinformation happening during the COVID period. People were obviously at home. People didn't know, you know, what to do or what to fill the time with. And the unfortunate thing was that they, you know, they started jumping down a lot of rabbit holes, and people were having discussions a lot more on the social media platforms. And the downside was of all this was literally, this is obviously as people were, you know, confined in various places around the world to their dwellings, to their, you know, homes. Now, deGrasse Tyson's presentation was about understanding the Earth and understanding and a discussion whether the Earth is actually round or if the Earth has a slightly, what's the term that they use? It's not a perfect circle, but it has a little bit of an oval shape to it, but not oval as extreme to the actual oval term or description that it has. But, you know, and having these various particular discussions about what Earth, you know, some interesting facts about Earth. And one of the interesting facts was specifically the size of Earth's atmosphere, that it's about a 25 kilometer in width. So from the surface of the Earth, from the surface of the ground that you stand on, that you live on, up to the heavens that you see above you, there is a 20, 5 kilometer layer of gases that protect us from anything outside of there, which can be anything from an asteroid to anything from the harmful sun, the harmful rays of the sun, so on and so forth. Now that in itself is a scary thought to technically have to, you know, have to acknowledge, and it's a scary realization that you get to, that we only have that 25 kilometer layer of gas. If you don't know, it's obviously the three forms of how three forms of substances on this planet: solids, liquids, gas. Gases are what you find in Earth's atmosphere, and you can, and it's one of, they are one of the reasons specifically as to why we've got the atmosphere, the weather systems, and so on and so forth that we experience, enjoy, and sometimes we are at risk of being exposed to adverse reactions by said atmosphere. Now, understanding the planet, human curiosity regarding the planet, and human curiosity regarding where our planet finds itself, this has obviously meant that, you know, we need to put dreams that we are having into reality. Now, space exploration was one such particular activity, or one such particular dream, that was consigned to a place that at one stage one would think of as being a fanciful idea. Remember, the aeroplane is literally 130 years old. The aeroplane. And it has been shown that literally much of humanity's developments and innovations is something like a 300 to a 400 year or to a 600 year time period out of the close to 6 to 10,000 years of human civilization. I'll say it again. A 600 year period of rapid development, industrialization, as well as also improvement of livelihoods and standards, as well as also finding the necessary innovations and discoveries that actually add value to human life. And that is a 600 year period versus the 10, probably the 20,000 years of civilization of humanity. Civilization. Not the existence of us humans, not the existence of how we understand the natural world or natural history. Natural history includes things like the existence of animals, the first dinosaurs, the various particular periods of life on this planet. As humans, we are technically at most a 10,000 year period, and we've only indicated human development, human prosperity in the last 600 years out of that 10,000. Now, our discussion, dear listeners, takes us into the planetary exploration scenario, as mentioned a little bit earlier, because planetary exploration is one of the most interesting developments that humankind have obviously endeavored to try and achieve. Now, if you try to look up the various particular discussions, obviously, of space travel and being able to, be in space in its entirety, the discussions obviously popped up since the 1960s. You could probably push it to the 1950s, but let's start from the 1960s in earnest. Now, Soviet scientists became interested in planetary exploration since the 1960s, when Venus, the second planet from the sun, with Earth being the third from the sun, felt like the closest science project to further human discovery and curiosity. Now, introducing the Venera space program, a program meant to send the first probes to another planet and to discover or gather information on what is actually going on there. But it was also a scenario of understanding whether or not it was smooth, because it did not go down smoothly, as we thought space travel probably would be. And Venus proved to be an even more interesting and far more challenging aspect to deal with. Now, as mentioned, planetary exploration has obviously been a conversation that popped up in recent years, in the past 5 years. Obviously, Elon Musk and his SpaceX program, where he has been boasting about the colonization of Mars, and that he's an active proponent of said particular activity to Mars, which obviously sort of like tells the rest of us humans here on the planet Earth that, you know, he doesn't want anything to do with us, and he actually wants to be outside of the realm of Earth's particular, laws, the laws that govern all of us, the laws that dictate and make life predictable for all of us. And the particular conversation, and it's, don't worry, it's nothing steered in the opposite direction against Elon Musk. There's nothing against Elon Musk. It's just Elon, you know, doesn't feature in this conversation. However, the particular scenario of, you know, bringing him up obviously stems towards the recent interest in planetary exploration that we've seen happen in various, in one or other particular element of information sharing, or even of having discourse and conducting discourse about interplanetary travel potentially. Now, 2 years back, 2024, a Japanese billionaire was one of the first space tourists, because he had the opportunity of going up into space to the space station and coming back down. And it was obviously something that was great for him. It was unfortunately not anything that everyone else can do, because the ticket cost something like a million, or was it 10 million to go up and then come down? Which obviously has to show or indicate to anyone else that, you know, it's not an easy thing to actually do. Now, this is obviously not in the realm of highlighting what the world's wealthy is up to, but it's actually to show you that space travel and being interested in the realm of space has been something that has been part of us. Now, when we talk about the first space explorer, space planetary, or the first planetary interest shown by space agencies on Earth, the Venera space program was the first, actually, to look at planetary exploration and trying to understand what planets, you know, are there in close proximity to us. Now, we obviously know that there are two planets adjacent to us, meaning in front of us and behind us. Mars is behind us. Mars has been a project, obviously, that the Americans had been looking at. And said particular project by said Americans was a discussion of, let's try and get there. What will we get there? And so, you know, NASA has done its part to go and interrogate their curiosity about Mars. But Venera, which began before NASA's planetary exploration discussion, was interested in Venus. Now, just to bring up a few interesting pointers about Venus, guys. If you're going to ask me why Venus, yeah, I'll get to the why Venus component. But the facts, a few facts about Venus, which are pretty astonishing things, but actually you can also get to understand why the planet is what it ultimately is. Now, a day on Venus is longer, or is close to being as long as one of our years. I'll say it again. One day on Venus is almost one of our years. as you currently look at time, as you currently go and stand in the day, and you see morning start, then you get into the late morning period, and you get into the lunch period, meaning the midday period, and then into the afternoon period, and from the afternoon into the nighttime period, that transition of time gives you an indication of the 24-hour cycle that we know of. And then there is how long it takes us to spin around the sun. For Venus, for them to spin on their own axis, to see a full day, is 243 days of our year. I'll say it again. It's 243 days for them to go through a day. That is their 24-hour day, which is not 24 hours because their day is actually 243 days long. For them to spin around the earth, for them to spin around the sun, it's 224 days or 225 because it's 224.7 days that is indicated here. For them to spin around the sun, it's 224.7 Earth days. Which makes it even more precarious because for Earth to spin around the sun, it's 365 days. Our year, our calendar year. So that means Earth, firstly on its axis, we spin faster. That's why we have the 24-hour day cycle. And for Earth to swing around the sun, we are slower than Venus, than Venus, because we take an extra 130 something days for us to technically move around the sun. Venus is hotter than Mercury. Now, Venus being further from the sun than Mercury. Mercury is the first planet, that's the closest planet to Mercury, to the sun. Venus is second, then comes Earth, then comes Mars. Its mean temperature, so meaning its average temperature, is 462 degrees Celsius. It is scorching hot on Venus. This is because of the high concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Venus, which works to produce an intense greenhouse gas effect. Now, the heat is trapped in the atmosphere like a blanket, because if you look at Venus, and it has got a murky, milky white color to it, and even if you stand in your backyard and you try to look up to the stars, what the platforms and the literature that I've got here, what they tell you is you've got to look for this, for the brightest star to look at. The brightest star is Venus. Because Venus, you can see Venus with your naked eye. Now, I tried that exercise last night in preparation for this morning, for this morning's discussion. And I looked up at the sky last night, here about 9 p.m. at night. Looked up at the sky and tried to make out, can I see it with all the trees in my backyard? Because primarily that was my biggest concern. If you try to look up at the heavens and you try to look up and see, okay, what's actually there? Well, what can I see with my naked eye? And I couldn't discern what Venus was. Now, apparently, Venus is pretty bright. I had to lock on a specific location because it seemed like the most stable let's call it sort of like the closest indication of a very strong light, and I'm still not sure if it is the right particular item that I saw or the right particular celestial body that I saw, but yeah, I had to settle on what I could see last night. Because the platforms kept telling me that you can see Venus with your naked eye. And you can see Mars with your naked eye. Venus is a white light. Strong, stable white light. It's not a star. It looks like a star, but it's not a star. Because Venus shines just as prominent as the moon. Because if you see the moon, you'll be able to see Venus in some parts. And if you can see Venus, then you just need to turn the opposite direction. You'll be able to supposedly, I say supposedly, see Mars, which is a red light. It also looks like a strong, stable, red star, but it's not a star because it's a light. Now, there's also something you need to know, that if you look up to the night sky and you see blue stars or blue-white, or if you see red stars, you have to understand that those are also galaxies that you can see with your naked eye. No, I'm not joking, and no, I'm not making this up. This is the knowledge that we've got at our hands. Now, the greenhouse gas effect, obviously, from what is happening with Venus, is that Venus is known as one of the particular sort of like gas planets in our system, in our solar system. Venus also spins clockwise on its axis. Primarily that almost all the planets in the solar system spin anti-clockwise on their axis and orbit the sun in an anti-clockwise direction. Venus also orbits the sun in an anti-clockwise orbit, but it spins on a clockwise axis, meaning for it to have its day, it spins on an axis by itself. Earth does the same thing. That's why we've got 24-hour day. For Venus, they've got the 243-day length. Now, one particular theory for this unusual rotation, meaning swinging anti-clockwise around the sun but spinning clockwise on its own axis, is that Venus was supposedly knocked off. That's a theory. It was knocked off its upright position earlier in history. Now, it's a theory. This is what the scientists highlight. And this was that supposedly, which is also one of the particular scenarios of evidence, that it is the only other planet in the solar system to spin clockwise alongside Uranus, which is the other planet that spins clockwise on its own axis but spins anti-clockwise around the sun. Venus is the second brightest natural object in the night sky, just to let you know, after the moon. So if you see the moon, you should also be able to see Venus, because it actually shines a little bit bright. And that Venus has 90 times the atmospheric pressure of Earth. What does that mean? If you land on Venus as a human today, you will immediately be squashed by the atmospheric pressure of Venus. I'll say it again. If you land right now on Venus, if you go as a human, space travel to Venus, you try to do the Elon Musk to Venus, you will be squashed immediately. The moment your ship lands, okay, even the moment that the ship enters the atmosphere of Venus, the ship, the vessel that you'll be traveling in, will be crushed because of the atmospheric pressure on Venus. And I will explain why, guys. Because this is actually the information and the knowledge that the Soviets shared from their first probe that proved this particular anomaly of atmospheric pressure. Now, obviously, just to let you know, that Venus is obviously named after the Roman goddess of love and beauty, who goes by the same name, Venus. Now, it is thought that Venus was named after the beautiful Roman goddess, a counterpart to the Greek goddess Aphrodite, due to its bright, shining appearance in the sky. Now, of the five planets known to ancient astronomers, it would have been the brightest that had been seen. Venus was also the first planet to have its motion plotted across the sky, meaning there was a photo, and I'm watching the photo right now. It was spotted with the naked eye, and this is primarily how Venus was seen in comparison to the sun. This means after its motion was plotted across the sky as early as the second millennium BC. Because Venus is so easy to spot with the naked eye, it is impossible to say who discovered the planet. But over the centuries, humans, or us humanity, have been able to measure Venus's motions, including the rare transit of Venus, meaning when the planet appears to cross in front of the sun. And it's a surprising photo. It's actually a photo that was taken in 2012 by an astronomy photographer back then. And it shows this massive ball of the sun and its intricate, you know, situations. And you see this little blot of Venus. And unfortunately, Venus literally looks like a little blot on the sky. So, and yes, there's even a term for something from Venus, meaning, following the rules of Latin, we should say Venerian as the adjective to describe things related to Venus, meaning anything that comes from Venus. Obviously, it would be deemed as being alien, but anything coming from Venus would have to be called Venerian. However, this is deemed to be too close to the word venereal, meaning it would create confusion. So the more commonly used word to describe something from Venus or something taken from Venus is Venusian, which is a little bit of a clunky term for origin in its own right. Before we continue, guys, we quickly take a short musical break. We come back right after this.
Just Cosa vuoi? Un gelato al pomodoro, un castello di cacao, Trevignese, caffè 33, ma Roma 6.
E poi.
Sì, io Rossi cosa vuoi? Pilotare un autojet, far la doccia di champagne, con fracco coco e sbancare il casino.
And coming back there from the sounds of Till Bronner with the song Viva la Felicita. And obviously just a little throwing a little bit of jazz in there before the sounds, or after the sounds of Empire of the Sun with Television. And you're obviously here in your 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Well, the discussion where we look into a lot of particular history, historical backgrounds of a lot of particular developments and ultimately what had happened. Now, I gave you the facts just before the musical break regarding Venus and Venus's particular allure. Well, not allure primarily, but the Venus sort of like facts, the bare bones facts about Venus and its own right. Now, the particular idea behind space exploration is that when you look at space exploration in its entirety, it's about investigation, which obviously means either by crewed or by uncrewed spacecraft sent from Earth. And this is obviously to try and understand the realms of the greater unknown out there around our planet. And obviously also the use of information that had been gained to increase the knowledge of the cosmos, which aims to benefit us, humanity, on the planet. Now, we've always been interested, we've always been curious about the particular realm around us, and we've obviously wondered about the nature of the objects that were seen in the night sky, and even more. And even to understand why we've got something like meteorites that fall to Earth's surface. Now, with the particular development of rockets and the advancements in electronics and other technologies in the 20th century, it became possible to send machines and animals and then people above Earth's atmosphere into outer space. Now, well before the technology made these achievements were possible, however, space exploration had already captured the minds of many people, and not only aircraft pilots and scientists, but also writers and artists. So, obviously during the beginning phase, the start phases of the Cold War, there was a space program that the Soviets had known as Venera. Now, Venera, which is technically Russian for Venus, the Venera program was a series of space probes that was developed by the Soviet Union between 1961 and 1984 to gather information about the planet Venus. Now, this included a total of 18 probes that were sent, which included two related Vega probes. Now, 13 probes successfully entered the Venusian, which is obviously the term that we've got to use, atmosphere, which also included the two Venera Hawley probes. Now, 10 of these 13 were successfully landed on the planet, on the surface of the planet. And due to the extreme conditions, the probes could only survive for a short period on the surface of the planet, from 23 minutes to 2 hours. Let me say this again. Venus, then its atmospheric pressure is 90 times more than that of Earth and its atmospheric pressure. 90 times. The surface of Venus is way more cooking. Oh, it has higher cooking levels, meaning it's way past the boiling point of water, 100 degrees Celsius, or is it 60 degrees Celsius? Between 60 and 100. With 240 degrees Celsius, that is an extreme on the surface of Venus. Now, just imagine to yourself what kind of hardware had to be sent to Venus to try and study Venus's particular surface and to understand what's going on in Venus. Now, the Venera program established a number of precedents in space exploration, and among them obviously being the first man-made devices to enter the atmosphere of another planet. This was Venera 3 on 1 March 1966. It also included the first precedent to make a soft landing on another planet, which was Venera 7 on 15 December 1970, and also the other particular achievement, the first to return images from another planet's surface, which was Venera 9 on 8 June of 1975. The second, and it was also the first to record sounds on another planet, which was Venera 13 on 30 October 1981. And it was also the first to perform high-resolution radar mapping scans, which was Venera 15 on 2 June 1983. The intense pressures that led to the short lifespans of many of the probes that were sent by the Soviets was itself specifically an important finding. Now, remember what I told you just a few minutes ago. The moment your ship, if you thought about traveling as a space, you know, as a space pilot to the planet Venus, which is second from the sun. Firstly, besides even just the atmospheric pressure and the intense temperatures on Venus, please understand that Venus is literally being bride, not barbecued, it's being bride for 243 days of the year. Because for Venus to face the sun for so long, obviously has to tell anyone, that's where a lot of the particular problems also come from. Because Venus is exposed per day for 243 days in one day. Meaning for one day, it's from night to night, it's 243 days in length. That is extreme. That is extreme. That means the sun heats up Venus a lot quicker. If you have to understand why Earth is what Earth is in our solar system, and how is it possible for Earth to have life on it, and how is it possible for Earth to have the wonderful conditions that we live in on it, you have to ask questions by look. You have to ask these questions by looking at the other planets in our orbit, or in the other, not in our orbit, but the other planets in our system. Meaning, okay, what happens if you're too close to the sun? And what happens if you're too far from the sun? And what happens if you just don't have the right particular makeup happening on your surface to achieve a particular platform or a particular desired status? How did Earth get to have life on it? And remember, it's a discussion in terms of where you've got to ask the question of how did Earth even, how did the oceans happen, and how did the continents happen, and then how did the other particular things associated to life on Earth actually happen? And no, I'm not talking about a Bible story. Let me say that as well. I'm not talking about a Bible story. It's something far more impactful to look at, because if you go and look at a crocodile in the Kavango or in the Zambezi rivers, you're looking at a dinosaur. The crocodile is the actual last living dinosaur. Go and ask yourself that question. How is that animal, obviously through the adaptability and adaptability and its survival, you know, in its own particular survival mechanisms. That has obviously seen it survive for so long in the extreme conditions of Earth as we know it, you know, back then and up until now and the various particular periods in Earth's history. So yeah. There is a lot that you can look at from that particular perspective. Now, when planetary exploration became a thing now, between the various space programs, and obviously try and understand what's going on in our particular solar system, one of the particular things, obviously, that was looked at was, do we know anything about the planets around us besides just the names that were given to them? This means getting samples, understanding the atmospheres, understanding the magnetic fields, understanding I almost said magnetism again, but it's the gravity of what gravity is on each planet. And what are the seasons? Are there seasons? Are there other indicators in time and in how things operate on some planets and how it doesn't operate on our planet? And what happens on our planet that we can try and look for on their planets? Various particular things. And one particular interesting point that also pops up in the space exploration discussion, and this is now from Mars, is that the knowledge that NASA has collected so far about Mars was that Mars does actually have some sort of a seasonal situation on it. There is a winter. It just gets super cold. And the rest of Mars is not boiling or cooking hot, but it just has supposedly a bearable atmosphere to endure as a human. I say a bearable atmosphere to endure. It's just, when you look at Mars, just remember that Mars is one massive desert. And they've also realized that Mars did have rivers on it. Mars did have various particular indicators of possibly something on it. Now, when I say it did have rivers, meaning it had identified possible river streams or riverbeds or things that possibly did have an indication of a water source. But obviously it might be different because, once again, Mars has a different atmosphere from us, so you can't just go and breathe there. Another thing is also, besides Mars's climatic conditions, is that they've got some interesting weather anomalies. They've got dust storms that cover the whole planet. It's not a dust storm just in the Sahara Desert, or a dust storm just there close to Dubai, or there in the Middle East. When I say a dust storm, I mean it's a storm that covers the whole planet. The whole planet. Remember this. The whole planet. Now, we'll quickly take another short musical break as we get close to the midway point here on this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. And obviously you and my company, Dwight, from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. This is obviously in the second half. We get to look at the particular probes and what they actually discovered from their activities and their interactions on the Venusian surface. And on that note, we'll be back right after this.
Quando l'anno e il giorno e l'ora in cui forse tu mi bacerai, ogni istante attenderò fino a quando d'improvviso ti vedrò sorridente accanto a me. Se vuoi dirmi di sì, devi dirlo perché non ha senso per me la mia vita senza te. Dimmi quando tu verrai, dimmi quando e baciandomi dirai non ci lasceremo mai. Andiamo te su. Quando l'anno, il giorno e l'ora in cui forse tu mi bacerai, ogni istante attenderò fino a quando d'improvviso ti vedrò sorridente accanto a me. Se vuoi dirmi di sì, devi dirlo perché non ha senso per me la mia vita senza te. Dimmi quando tu verrai, dimmi quando e baciandomi dirai non ci lasceremo mai. We'll be right back.
choice. A never ask, just given. All day, all year, too close, too near. I never wanted to listen. I don't look for congratulations or to hear the crowd applaud. It's just this reckless mind wasting time. Lost every time that I fought. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've never finished, the person I'll never be. Oh, 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 oh. Just stones in clients, way hard on this mind, pushing on doors that won't open. I've drowned out any meditation. I've breathed until the air ran out. It's just this mixed up mind, wasting time, putting my decisions in doubt. With a mind full of madness and a heart.
And obviously there were the sounds of Take That with a Mind Full of Madness. Before that was once again Till Bronner with the song Quando, Quando, Quando. And bring us up past the midway point of this morning's session here in your number one talk station. This is my Sunday morning take, as we've been looking in the first half of this morning's program into the space exploration and planetary exploration, for that matter, in terms of, you know, why it happens, which also included the interest in Venus. Now, we get into the second half of this morning's program with looking into the probes that the Soviet space program, or the Soviet Venera planet exploration program, had engaged in. These particular probes are known, the first probes, or the whole probe program, actually was known as the Venera Project. And the obvious particular first indicators were based on, you know, let's send the first two probes. Now, you had Venera 1 and Venera 2. Now, Veneta 1 and 2 was that these were the first Soviet attempts at a flyby probe to Venus that was launched on 4 February 1961. But it failed to leave Earth's orbit. Obviously, you can see the particular disaster in there because it never left the surface of the Earth. Now, in keeping with the Soviet policy at the time of not announcing details of failed missions, interesting, because if you guys also understood what happened during the Cold War was that there was a lot of information management, which also technically meant censorship, which also technically meant that you never knew if something was a hit or a miss. Now, the launch was announced under the name of Tiageli Sputnik, meaning heavy satellite. It is also known as Venera 1VA, and as with some of the Soviet Union's other planetary probes, the later versions were launched in pairs, with a second vehicle launched soon after the first. So if they see the first one is not successful, then they've already designed and manufactured the second guy, and they try again. So based on the information they got from trying to launch the first guy, they then use the new knowledge to try and adjust and work on the second guy. So then to try and launch the second guy and then work from there to try and pilot or steer it to where it needs to go, which is pretty genius. Now, Venera 1 and Venera 2 were intended to fly past Venus without entering its orbit. Venera 1 was launched on 12 February 1961. Telemetry on the probe failed 7 days after launch, and it is believed to have passed within 100,000 kilometers of Venus. Let me say this again. The first probe that the Soviets tried was not a Venera probe, but it was a probe that was given a name of heavy satellite in order for it to try and monitor Venus. So when the actual Venera probes were launched, or Venera program was begun, it actually reached its particular destination, and it actually had to try and do a flyby. Flyby meaning it just flies around Venus. It doesn't enter Venus's atmosphere. So the telemetry on the probe failed 7 days after its launch. It is believed to have passed within 100,000 kilometers of Venus, and it still remains in heliocentric orbit, meaning the probe is still hanging out there around Venus, somewhere around Venus. Venera 2 was launched on 12 November 1965, but also suffered a telemetry failure after leaving Earth's orbit. Now, several other failed attempts at Venus flyby probes were launched by the Soviet Union in the early 60s, but were not announced as planetary missions at the time, and hence did not officially receive the Venera designation. Venera 3 to Venera 6. Now, Venera 3 to Venera 6 probes were similar in construction. They weighed approximately 1 ton, and they were launched by the Molniya type booster rocket. They obviously also included a cruise bus and a spherical atmospheric entry probe. Now, the probes were optimized for atmospheric measurements, but not equipped with any special landing apparatus, meaning that if they entered the surface or the atmosphere of Venus, the potential was pretty high that the thing would just fall to the surface of the planet. And how it was explained in the one documentary that I watched about the Venera program was also that the probe potentially had to use a parachute in some cases. But that was also not 100% guaranteed, because the aim was to try and understand what was up with the planet. What is Venus all about? So, you know, it was more like hit and miss attempts, and let's go and see what's there instead of just we are guessing things from where we are on Earth. Now, as mentioned, it didn't have any special landing gear, the Venera probes from 3 to 6. Now, the probes, obviously, they weren't also any special hopes placed on them, just to say that as well. Meaning that it was wishful thinking, hoping that they would reach Venus, meaning that they would at least reach the orbit of Venus, meaning being able to circle, to go around Venus, and then to potentially enter. Because here's one of the weird things that we sometimes forget about a planet. A planet spins. Now, when a planet spins, anything, any particular outside external item or object that tries to enter the atmosphere of a planet will always enter at an angle. Let me say that again. Since planets in our solar system spin on their axis, meaning they spin where they are standing, and then they also spin around the sun. So while they're spinning, to give you your 24-hour day indication, because they're spinning on their axis, the Earth also spins around the sun. Now, Venus does the same thing. It's just Venus spins a lot slower on its axis, but it actually rotates quicker around the sun than us. Let me say it again. They rotate quicker around the sun than us. They go around the sun 225 days. We take 365 days to go around the sun. Venus, for its 1 day length, is 243 days. Not 24 hours. So, with obviously highlighting to you that Venus has a very slow axis that it spins on, and it travels around the sun a lot quicker than we do, meaning that, sure, if you had to shoot the probe directly at Venus, the probe could probably come or enter the atmosphere of Venus on a pretty straight trajectory. But if you had to think about the template of what we sit with at Earth, for Earth, is that, you know, anything that tries to enter Earth's surface will always enter at an angle because the Earth is spinning. And since the Earth is spinning, that angle will always be to the left. Now, I've got an interesting exercise for you to go and test at home. Specifically to go and to see for your own eyes and to be aware about the Earth spinning. And even though you might not feel the spinning, just test this. Go and take any object that is heavy enough and you try to drop it. And you try to see if it lands precisely on the mark that you've designated on the floor or on a table. And tell me if it does not fall to the left. That's what the astronomers and the scientists have highlighted. Because of Earth's particular movement, because since the Earth spins on its own axis, it's creating a force primarily that impacts how things fall. Very subtly, sure. But it is a interesting observation to make. Now, with the Venera programs, obviously, and highlighted to you already that we've already had Venera 1 and 2, from 3 to 6, the idea was obviously, how does the thing land? There wasn't much effort placed into, you know, how do you get to land the thing if we don't even know what's going on the planet? Now, since it was hoped that the probes would reach the surface of the planet, of Venus, the first probes failed almost immediately, which then immediately also disabled the data transmissions from these probes to Earth. Venera 3 became the first human-made object to impact another planet's surface as it crash-landed on 1 March 1966. However, as the spacecraft's data probes had failed upon atmospheric penetration, no data from the Venusian atmosphere was retrieved from the mission. On 18 October of 1967, Venera 4 became the first spacecraft to measure the atmosphere of another planet. This spacecraft first showed the major gas of Venus's atmosphere to be carbon dioxide. That's how we know, because of Venera 4. Now, while the Soviet Union initially claimed the craft reached the surface intact, reanalysis specifically of what had happened and what the craft was measuring included atmospheric occultation, data from the American Mariner 5 spacecraft that flew by Venus the day after its arrival, which demonstrated that Venus's surface pressure was between 75 to 100 atmospheres. I'll say it again. Its atmospheric pressure is between 75 to 100 atmospheres, much higher than Venera 4's 25 atm hull strength, and the claim was later on retracted. Now, this obviously would tell you that if Venera 4 reached the surface of the planet, it probably was crashed or smashed because of the atmospheric pressure. Now, realizing the ships would be crushed before reaching the surface, the Soviets launched Venera 5 and Venera 6 as atmospheric probes, designed to jettison nearly half their payload prior to entering the planet's atmosphere. These craft then recorded 53 and 51 minutes of data, respectively, while slowly descending by parachute before their batteries failed. Now, this represented a significant scientific accomplishment. It had become increasingly clear that Venus was unlikely to have liquid bodies of water, but designs for the Soviet Venera probes still considered the possibility of a water landing as late as 1964. Venera 7. Venera 7 probe, launched on August 1970, was the first one designed to survive Venus's surface conditions and to make a soft landing. Now, massively overbuilt to ensure survivability, it had few experiments on board, and scientific output from the mission was further limited due to an internal switchboard failure that stuck in the transmit temperature position. Still, the control scientists succeeded in extrapolating the pressure, which was at 90 atm, that's the pressure indicate, you know, the measurement that they use, from the temperature data with 465 degrees Celsius, which resulted from the first direct surface measurements to be made about Venus. Now, the Doppler measurements of the Venera 4 to 7 probes were the first evidence of the existence of zonal winds with high speeds of up to 100 meters per second in the Venusian atmosphere. So this meant that Venus had super rotation. Now, super rotation is when the atmosphere of Venus is so dense, technically just describing it once again, that it's a very dense layer of gases surrounding the planet. And this primarily means that since the atmosphere of Venus consists of 96% carbon dioxide and 4% of nitrogen, with other chemical compounds present only in trace amounts, this means it's a lot denser and a lot hotter than the planet Earth. Now, along with the pressure and that temperature data acquired by Venera 7, it also measured atmospheric composition, which is the particular traits that I just highlighted to you. So Venera 7's parachute also failed shortly after landing very close to the surface. It impacted at 17 meters per second and toppled over, but survived. Now, this caused antenna misalignment, making the radio signal very weak, but it was detected with temperature telemetry for 23 more minutes before its batteries expired. This means that it became, on 15 December 1970, the first human-made probe to transmit data from the surface of Venus. Now, obviously, you can see the successes so far, up until Veneta 7. Yes, you can obviously also see that with scientific endeavor. Try and try and try again. Now, here's the thing that we need to understand here, guys. From what you can hear that I've just highlighted to you. This means that if something fails, you have to try again. This means, yes, it's money wasted. On the first attempt, on the second attempt, on the third attempt, on the fourth attempt, on the fifth attempt, even on the seventh attempt. It's money that was wasted. But it was giving back indications of what to fix, what to get right. And remember, this is an SOE, eh, that built these things. It was an SOE. Which has to tell you as well that in the pursuit of knowledge and scientific endeavor and other particular, you know, developments regarding the advancement of humanity, yes, there will be failures. There will be failures. Which actually shows research and development is a process not just of positives, but it's about trial and error. Testing and testing. And testing again. And improving on the previous results. And trying to improve to find the best outcomes. So we should not be afraid of testing. And we should not be afraid of developing. And we should not be afraid of making mistakes along the side, along the way. With Veneta 8, after the success of Veneta 7, Veneta 8 launched in 1972, and it was equipped with an extended set of scientific instruments for studying the surface of the planet Venus. Now, the cruise bus of Veneta 7 and Veneta 8 was similar to that of the earlier Veneras, with the design ascending to the Zond 3 mission, or ascending, yeah, meaning moving up to the Zond, to another space mission that the Soviets were also developing. Now, the lander transmitted data during the descent and landed in sunlight. Now, it measured the light level but had no camera. It transmitted the data for almost an hour. Success from 23 minutes. No, not 23 minutes. It had transmitted 23 minutes more. But it was a success. Because at least for an hour, real data was being transmitted back to Earth about Venus. We got to understand in 2026, what's on Venus? What's on the second rock from the sun? Since we are the third rock from the sun, Earth, and Mars is the fourth one from the sun, what's on the third rock? Oh no, on the second rock from the sun. What's going on there? So we know it's gas. I almost said a gas giant, but it's not a giant because Venus and us, we are the similar size. Venus rotates slower than us, but Venus is a mystery. What's going on there? Venus 9 to 12, or not Venus, but Veneta 9 to 12 were the next steps to take. Now, following the failed Cosmos 482, this was a particular development because Cosmos 482 was another space program of the Soviets. Cosmos 482 was an attempted Soviet Venus probe. It was launched in 1972, and it failed to escape also once again Earth's low orbit. And because of this, its name was retrospectively changed to Cosmos, which was used for Earth orbiting satellites. Now, the 1975 Venera 9 and 10 probes and the 1978 Venera 11 and 12 probes were of different designs, meaning they were different designs even from the Cosmos 482 low orbit event or project that didn't exit Earth's orbit. Now, they weighed approximately 5 tons and were launched by the powerful Proton booster. They included a transfer and a relay bus that had engines to break into Venus's orbit, and to also serve as a receiver and relay for the entry probe's transmissions. Now, the entry probe was also attached to the top of the bus in a, and I'm not talking about an actual bus. I'm talking about, it's a particular design of the rocket itself that gets the probe to its destination. But it's called a bus just because of its transportability or the function of transport that it plays. And the interesting thing, obviously, was that the probe, was positioned in a spherical heat shield, meaning protect the scientific equipment a lot better against its potential entry into this harsh environment that Venus has. Now, the probes are also optimized for surface operations with an unusual design that included a spherical compartment to protect the electronics from atmospheric pressure and heat as well for as long as possible. Beneath this was a shock-absorbing crush ring for landing. Now, a crush ring, you would sometimes see them in sports cars. They would be called the roller bars, if you guys did not know. You also see it sometimes at gas, on gas bottles. You know, the gas bottle that you buy for your gas stove at home, or even the gas bottles that get supplied to hospitals and other businesses. It has a drop, you can call it a drop ring in that regard, but it's literally this, it's literally a piece of metal that is welded to the bottom of the structure of the item, which serves as said particular shock absorbing element. And it plays that particular role because, you know, it needs to stand, the cylinder needs to stand, the gas cylinder needs to be able to be stored properly and to be moved properly as well. You know, so it's about movement, logistics, storage, as well as also handling, and finally also the ability to absorb if you accidentally drop the cylinder. Now, above the pressure sphere was a cylindrical antenna structure and a wide dish-shaped structure that resembled an antenna that was actually an aerobrake. So they applied a lot of brakes on this particular probe itself. Obviously with the aim that the probes now have to start achieving, you know, desired success outcomes. So they were designed, all of them were designed, they were all designed to operate on the surface for a minimum of 30 minutes. For a minimum. The instruments varied on different missions, but included cameras and atmospheric and soil analysis equipment, and all four landers had problems with some or all of their camera lens caps not releasing. The Venera 9 lander operated for at least 53 minutes and took pictures with one of two cameras. The other lens cap did not release. These were the first pictures that were ever taken on the surface of another planet. Venera 10 lander operated for at least 65 minutes and took pictures with one of two cameras, and the other lens cap also did not release. Venera 11 lander operated for at least 95 minutes, but neither of the camera's lens caps had released. And Venera 12 lander operated for at least 110 minutes, meaning an hour and, is this 50 minutes? An hour and 50 minutes. But neither of the camera's lens caps had released as well. So, you saw success from 53 minutes, close to an hour, 65 minutes, an hour and 5 minutes, 95 minutes, an hour and 35 minutes, and 110 hours, an hour and 50 minutes, almost 2 hours of operation. So success at every particular step. But before we actually continue to listen, we're going to take a short musical break and we come back right after that. I wish that I could change the weather, enjoy the sound of silence in my car. There's things I just can't hear forever. I found a crowded place to fall apart. You could be me. You can blame it on a space, but blame it on Jackie. Blame it on me. We come back from the sounds there primarily of, who's that, the Eagles with One of These Nights. Leaving us with the last 20 minutes on this morning session still. I did see the phone line flashing a little bit earlier during one of the particular segments that I presented. But obviously, you know, just highlighting that we are talking about space exploration and primarily planetary exploration, for that matter, and what it actually means. Now, as you can hear from the discussions regarding the Venera programs or the Venera probes, is that trial and error went from the very first particular probe that the Soviets tried to launch to the very last probe that actually provided, you know, actual, you know, real information to work from. Transmitting a lot longer, being able to technically gather a little bit more knowledge than possible, obviously with the cameras being a little bit wonky and not being able to function properly. But we sit with a particular picture and a view of what are we actually looking at. Now, remember, satellites by now. Okay, let me first get the first caller coming through. Eagle FM, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
How are you doing, Uncle Bona?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing, sir?
I'm all right, I'm all right.
Happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day, Uncle Bona.
Happy Independence Day, I'm okay.
Yeah.
How are you doing, man?
All right, on your side.
Good.
Mm.
So, I just want to say some two things, man.
Not a problem.
It won't take that much long. So, yeah, this is space exploration.
Mm.
I heard some years back, they were also talking about this one is declining from Russia, this one is America, this one what was. I don't know the dynamic now this time around.
Yeah.
So, how is it going on? Is it, there's a lot of competition on that side, no? Because you can dominate the space.
Well,
it's like you have captured the whole world.
It's a little bit difficult, Angabon, to use the term dominate, because what we are hearing is primarily only from an American perspective or from a European perspective. Currently, right now, what I discovered is that the Europeans are more into observation. But when you go to the Americans are telling you the one about, they're the guys telling you about sending people to Mars and trying to land somewhere, which are all benefits.
Yeah. So, okay, fine. I don't know, because they say that if you are good in space, you can also control the what? You can also control some of this warhead and all these other things.
True, because satellites are also included there.
So, and the people are saying, you know, this one is, do you know what the Chinese are doing? Do you know what this one is doing? You know, they are providing this technological what they watch anymore. So now, is this thing faced? So have they reconciled? Because there was a time in Russia and the America, they disclaimed. I don't know which one of them will say, we are not going to work together again, and the contract must be renewed and things like that. How is it now? Compared to the war that is going on in relation to the war that is going on, the invasion of U.S., Israel into Iraq.
Angabana, back with the Ukraine conflict, the treaty, the space exploration treaty between the Russians and the Americans is one of the few treaties that was not touched because they share information and they both share the space station, in orbit. Mm-hmm. So meaning that they're still sharing information with us and they're still sharing the maintenance, observation and other particular related activities regarding that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that treaty is, it's not waterproof, but it's a treaty that exists And it's a treaty that allows them to still share knowledge and activities regarding the maintenance of the space station.
Yes, my brother. So now it's time, what I'm seeing now, so we have permission and space exploration and things like that. So, and then those men say handal by the moon. The men said that.
No, you're right.
Oh, so they go to the moon.
And they want to go almost now back. They want to go back to the moon.
Okay. How do you think, how possible is this? Because it's another different kind of apparently an earth.
Yeah.
Just like our earth here.
Yeah.
Somewhere down there.
Yeah.
And I was one time we looking at the Chinese, they sent some people in space.
Yeah.
They came with a lot of research findings and documents and they were there.
Yeah.
So now, I don't know how the government for the destruction of the moon. Sorry for the destruction of the moon. You know, anyway, and the privacy, and then all of a sudden the truck come,
Yeah.
I don't know why they cannot even transport their things with Trans-Namibia Railway. Is that thing functioning?
It is, yes, Angabona, because I sometimes hear it here close to where I live. You still hear the locomotive. So, yeah.
Okay. But they transport goods, like maybe in the north, Skango, Katina, there.
Maybe,
yeah. The time, when you see a truck, no? And I've been seeing this truck, you know, they call something. You know, these trucks are so big. Big.
Yeah.
So, can they start to... transporting their things with the things. And then the smaller ones, the good ones, those ones that you can really... Well, this one, it caused a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
In the roads.
Yeah.
So now the space. So I'm just, I don't know, I don't have knowledge on the things, my brother. So I'm just a really person who just want to know the curiosity, you know. But what I'm saying is that now, what's so their relationship, the treaty? Has the treaty ended, or is it no longer going to be renewed, or what is happening?
No, Uncle Bonner, it's a treaty that it. Okay, I didn't look into the treaty as yet, but it was when the Ukraine conflict began. It's that treaty, the nuclear weapons proliferation treaties that they've signed since the 1960s with each other, or since the 1950s. And the treaty on selling uranium are one of the few treaties that is not sanctioned, which the Americans did not sanction the Russians on because of the Ukraine war. Well, because Angabona, these are things that are outside of. It's sort of like in favor of global you know global affairs.
Yeah. I understand. Look at the what damage this truck. Yeah, so yes, now tell me because the Chinese. So they have invited President Trump, and he was saying that that meeting might be delayed because of the war, and the reason why he's going there is because. Of the war. Now, in terms of issues of that, what I wanted to say now. So that means whoever has the superiority and that space exploration and things like that will be the one that will now give you the proper picture of that area.
It's a maybe, Angabona, because here's the thing that I've learned sort of like when I've had now the chance to look at international relations. It's one of the mistakes that Namibia makes. And this is a serious particular scenario of how Namibia needs to value its own interests versus blindly just going with anything that's decided at the UN level.
Did you say at UN level?
At UN level, yeah, Angabona. Because
what is the level of UN? What is that? Is it helping anything?
For example, Angabona, remember our cybersecurity and data protection discussion that Helmut and I presented here in last month? And I realized for two years, when I went to that public engagement, the Ministry of ICT didn't communicate anything to the media or to the world, or not the world, to Namibia,
about that
UN convention that they were giving inputs into, because you want to understand from a Namibian perspective, what are we saying there at a UN level? Just for this presentation to happen here, and you're like, but what is this thing that you're presenting here? I mean, all the lawyers in Namibia, even the lawyers in South Africa will tell you, your data protection, your cybersecurity is based upon, if you have rights in your real life, like you and I, Uncle Bonner, like we are standing as real people, you must have the same rights in a digital space.
Exactly.
You can't go with a thing that says, go and define things for yourself. And when you ask the officials from the Ministry of ICT, how does this plan draft impact various laws that we already have? And then you get told, no, it works with the Communication Act, which technically means, okay, now we need to go look at the Communication Act. Is it just based upon trying to deal with malicious criminal activities, or is it trying to uphold the rights that we have in the Constitution? Which is a little bit of a problem, Angabona, because I've realized the big countries, they go say yes at a UN level, and then they do their own thing. And it's the small, small countries like Namibia who go follow the UN thing. We say yes, we go follow the UN thing, but we don't know how to implement the UN thing.
Yeah. It's a challenge. But what is, nevertheless, but what we should do, I understand your concern.
Mm.
But you see, there are so many things. Even this e-governance, all this e that you were mentioning, I think at one point with Helmut, and then they always pumping in governance. Like you are now talking about this cyber security, and the workshop just two, three weeks ago now, last month, when they concluded it is the workshop or summit that was there in Mutuku.
Yeah.
So now in all these things, because even the gambling.
Yeah.
The gambling where the bad things and all those ones, they have to be regulated by the law.
Yes, they have to be.
And they are from the manufacturer. I was listening to some of the lawyers speaking in David in South Africa. Those big lawyers. And then they were saying, yes, we have to follow and check
Sorry, Angabona. I didn't hear that part.
What I was saying is that when we want to do now those things, like what you are talking about, we need to make sure that we go down there.
Yeah.
So that we can have those things implemented. I just gave an example of e-governance, which might be, and then I was talking about this, betting, gambling online, digital gambling, to go, these other things. You know, most of these things, they are not taxed also. And they are just operating. Maybe they need to find now a formula as to how do we regulate this digital gambling from the manufacturer to the consumer and before it comes in. There are many, many things, like you are saying, that are not being implemented. The reports are not coming to the stakeholders because now, like that stakeholder that they had in the cyber security.
Yeah.
So, I believe all the stakeholders must have been doing them.
Yeah.
For them now to implement those things, to popularize those declarations to their own mandate. and see how they can incorporate.
But the worst thing is, Angabona, with those stakeholders that were sitting there, some of them came from a tech perspective and they didn't care about anything like rights. Meaning, they didn't care anything about rights, and you could see that these were also, professionals that were outside of their depth. So they probably came to see, okay, so what would the cybersecurity legislation say if you're from a UNAM and a NAS and an IUM perspective that has, ICT departments that have to, train, technicians, or that have to train students how to hack. Because they teach them how to hack, to do the ethical hacking. They teach them how to hack, Angabona.
So the response is the protection?
The protection is, so how the ethical hacking scenario works is that it is to test cyber defenses. So when you develop something for your company, you have to test the thing. So you try testing the hack. Or you try testing the defense by hacking the infrastructure, the digital infrastructure. Now, at this particular scenario, some of the people that were asking questions were asking from a perspective of saying, hey, listen, so would this impact the skills development that the institutions are doing regarding the students
the protection of data and information and data.
Because those students are taught how to hack. They literally have to do testing of infrastructure, and they literally have to look at the integrity of the infrastructure, so they are taught how to hack, which is some of the particular concerns, because this means the stakeholders were not consulted about what goes into the first draft. The draft was then just go and developed and brought to the Namibian economy. So once again, we don't trust our own people, Angabona, to develop our own thing for ourselves that speaks to our needs. It was just, we go and attend a thing at the UN level, and it's now, okay, this UN level thing looks now the best. Let's now adopt it just like that into Namibia. And then we find headaches along the side. And then we don't know how to deal with the headaches, because the headaches are practicalities, you know? Angabona, if you now say exactly, so I don't know what we're doing here in Namibia, because for 2 years I didn't even know about this UN convention.
So the one that talks about cyber crimes and other things.
Exactly, Angabona. Just hold on for me. We're quickly going into a short break.
Okay.
Titanium, the perfect fit between platinum and silver, complementing our existing benefit options. We always offer a comprehensive healthcare experience. NHP, the premier member-centric medical aid fund. Visit NHP today at nhp.com.na. NHP, we're about you.
Angabona, you have like an extra 25 seconds.
So, we summarize to sum up together, and like I was saying that I start having interest in this cyber crime, cyber security, and this thing, and how the vulnerable are more victims, they become victims of those things.
Mm.
And this is what we have seen a lot of times. This isn't happening.
Mm.
In terms of the law, like I was saying, it's similar to the one that South Africans that discussed with me. Down there, should also be, I know it's also included in the described one, that the prescribed one for UN.
Yeah.
The convention.
Yeah.
On GDPR and whatever. So now maybe what you can do is just to see, you guys, you are privileged, because people don't know our rights. You need to be educated. How do I protect? And now you see now organizations are also at risk.
Mm.
You know? And I listened to most of the guys all of last week. They were coming here being analyzed. to ask them questions about this particular issue. Mm. So thank you very much, my brother.
Not a problem, Angomona.
To give us more information as to how those streets are being entered.
Yeah.
Are they violating some rights somewhere or doing some kind of omission? Mm. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Not a problem.
Why don't you operate like this when you are with Helmut there? Is it because you say you are stingy? Stingy for who?
Okay, I'll ask him, Uncle Bruno. And I'll ask him on air so that he answers it.
If he's not going to be picking our call, then at that time when you start,
yeah,
we go for our training and do some other things. We come back by 6 when the young man was there, David is there.
No, I'll let him know.
Of course we are learning, but now learning. You don't even know the feedback whether you have learned something or what. You just comedian talking.
Yeah. Right? I'll let them know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ngobona.
Good.
Now, the conversation, obviously, that we left off just before the ad break, because it slightly pushed me over the 7 a.m. mark, but just where we left off with the Venera space programs was that there was actually also... two or four more probes that were developed, Veneta 13 and 14 and Veneta 15 and 16, just to give you an indication. Now, they advanced the technology, meaning they put in more advanced equipment to try and get more measurements and more information regarding Venus. And it actually provided a lot more feedback than the first four. Well, not the first four, but the previous four, which was Veneta 9 to 12. Now, just before we end our discussion, Veneta 13 and 14, which was launched between 1981 and 1982, each had a descent craft or lander that contained most of the instrumentation and electronics. And it also had a flyby spacecraft that was used as a communications relay. So they needed to set up, the probe needed to fly into the atmosphere, and the flyby craft needed to act as a satellite, as a relay station to send more information back to Earth. Meaning, being able to send a stronger signal, basically. The design was similar to the earlier Venera 9 to 12 landers, and they carried instruments to take more scientific measurements off the ground and atmosphere once the probe landed, which included cameras, a microphone, a drill, and a surface sampler, and a seismometer. They also had instruments to record electric discharges during its descent phase through the Venusian atmosphere. Now, the two descent craft landed about 950 kilometers from each other, which indicated that this was just east of the eastern extension of an elevated region, which is now known as the Phoebe Regio. Now, the Venera 13 lander survived for 127 minutes, and the Venera 14 lander survived for 57 minutes, where the planned design life was only 32 minutes for each. The Venera 14 craft had the misfortune of ejecting the camera lens cap directly under the surface compressibility tester arm, and the returned information for the compressibility of the lens cap rather than the surface. So it was reading something else as opposed to what its actual aim was. The descent vehicles transmitted data to the buses, which acted as data relays as they flew by Venus. Veneta 15 and 16, which happened in 1983, saw that these two spacecraft were orbiter missions similar to the previous probes, but the entry probes were replaced with surface imaging radar equipment. Radar imaging was necessary to penetrate the dense cloud of Venus, and both missions included identical synthetic aperture radar and radio altimeter systems. So the SAR systems was crucial in the mapping efforts of the mission and featured an 8-month operational tour to capture Venus's surface at a resolution of 1 to 2 kilometers. When the system was switched to radio altimeter mode, the antenna operated at an 8-centimeter wavelength band to send and receive signals off of the Venusian surface over a period of 0.6 milliseconds. The results were a detailed map of the reflectivity distribution over the surface of the Venusian northern hemisphere. The linear distance measurements that were taken ranged from 91 to 182 kilometers. And the twin Soviet spacecraft flew in near polar elliptical orbits, meaning the two spacecraft were to opposite ends of the planet. So technically that they had the opportunity of orbiting around the planet, relaying continuously information. Instead of now you having to wait for that relay to come around now and to come back, which will take a whole year. No, not a whole year. Wasn't it? Yeah. It technically is a whole year if you think about the axis of Venus. 224 days. My goodness. Now, the altimeter provided topographical data with a height resolution of 50 meters. And an East German instrument mapped surface temperature variations. And this obviously made things interesting. Now, there are photos in terms of the literature that I've got here in front of me. There are photos here that I can look at, but you can see that the camera, unfortunately, was at an angle that is not sufficiently good enough to see much. But you can actually see rocks. You can actually see sands. And this was an image that was taken by the Venera 9 lander way back, still in the 60s. No? 70s, I think. Much of the particular knowledge that they've shared gave valuable atmospheric and other related data sets and information sets that obviously have improved our understanding of how we look at Venus. Now, just to let you know, the name Venera for the Soviet mission is actually the Russian name for Venus. On that note, guys, it does bring us up to the end of this evening. I did say this evening already. But yeah, that's sort of like me fast-forwarding to a situation. But on this morning's session of my Sunday Morning Take, it is past 7 a.m., obviously, as I've appropriated a little bit more time from the next program that will follow on after the break. On that note, stay tuned. And let's see each other again during the course of the week on the home run. On that note, stay tuned for the rest of the programming during the rest of your Sunday here in our company.